What is it? What is it? It's about that time, y'all. Snap Judgment, the podcast from NPR.
Douglas was walking home from work. Been a long day, and in front of his apartment building, Doug sees a picture lying on the ground. He picks it up, and it's a photo of the building taken from right where he's standing. Doug opens the door, and there's another picture. It's of the foyer, taken again from right where he is standing. He walks up to his floor, and from the top of the stairs, Doug sees a final picture, way down the hall, lying right in front of his apartment. Welcome to Snap Judgment. What is Snap Judgment? It's that left, that right, jump, or don't. Snap Judgment, it's storytelling with a beat. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Snap Judgment from NPR, the show about the decisions people make that change everything. I'm your host, Glenn Washington, joining you from downtown Oakland, California, DJ AKA on the ones and twos. Now, sometimes you might just ask yourself, is this my beautiful house? You might just ask yourself, is that my beautiful wife? Maybe you can't put your finger on it, but something just ain't right. Today on Snap Judgment, we present a raft of stories where something is off. And we're going to start off, and I'm going to warn you, we're going to start off a little bit freaky, a little bit crazy, because Douglas was coming home from a long day, looking forward to relaxing with some TV, a cold brew. But the universe had other plans. Snap Judgment.
I walked into the apartment foyer, and I looked down, and there was a Polaroid photograph on the ground. So I picked it up, I looked at it, and it actually was a picture of what I was standing there looking at in real life. In other words, it was a picture of the door I was about to go through, a picture of the foyer in which I was standing.
Someone had taken a picture and thrown it on the ground.
Correct. So I walked over to the stairway and I looked, and there was another picture on the ground. Now, and it's a picture of the stairway.
Picture of the stairway. And you're like, what are you thinking at this point?
Now I'm just a little uneasy, because now from the first picture being maybe an accident, I dropped it on my way in. The second one, it's deliberate.
Somebody's up to something.
Yes. So at this point, I'm just becoming a little nervous. The hair started to go up on my arms for some reason.
So you get picture number three, you look at it, and you continue up towards your apartment.
So now I go to the hallway door that leads to the apartment wing. So I opened the door, and there on the ground was another photograph. And I can see down the hallway. It looked like a million miles down there. I can see my door, and I can see that there's a spill of light coming from the apartment across from my door, and that door is open. And there's another photograph, one last photograph, on the ground down at the end of the hallway. I, at this point, was scared out of my mind, because this was the end. I stood there for a moment, absolutely quiet.
You got to make a snap judgment right now. Either I'm going to go to my apartment, right, or I'm going to do something else. What did you do?
I practically fled that building.
What did you discover?
Discovered that after I had left, somebody noticed there was a guy, the apartment tenant of the apartment that had the open door, that was sitting in his window. And they called the police. They came, and he was mentally ill and had been off his medication and was threatening to jump. So they got him down and saved his life.
What did the final picture look like?
The final picture was of that window in which he was sitting, except that there was nobody in the picture. It was simply the open window.
He jumped.
I can only surmise that, yeah, he would have made that picture true, just like the other four. So it would have been a window without him in it, and he would have jumped to kill himself.
Trust those premonitions.
Yes, please do.
You trust yourself, Doug?
I do.
Snap Judgment. Big thanks to Douglas Leach for bringing us his story. In fact, we liked it so much that we made a movie. Check it out, snapjudgment.org. You're going to dig it. Now, next up, Lalat Petnayak. Big house, fancy car, beautiful wife, but suddenly seemed like he was fighting an unseen enemy. His eyes started being puffy. His fingers were swelling up. It seemed like as much as he worked out, it wasn't working out for him. He was beaten down. He was still a very, very young man. And people, being people, started to talk.
A lot of people thought, oh, he's just an easygoing guy. That's just the way he is. He's in Southern California, man.
Right, Southern California. They're laid back down there. So tell us, then. So bring us to kind of the culmination of this.
Okay. Occasionally, I would run into that friend or that family member that I haven't seen in 5 years, and it would shock them to see me. And so after I was married, people would mention that to Anisha, and Anisha, you know, say, well, no, that's just the way he is. He's probably just overworked and tired and, you know, just gained a little bit of weight.
So when I met him, he was already slurring, and I thought that's the way he talked.
There's a point in time where things got a little serious. I would get up and spit up blood. And I thought, okay. I'd get up, and my health started getting worse. I'd get up and I had these, you know, I get goosebumps as I'm saying this now. I'd have these nightmares. And the nightmare was I would see thick black snakes crawling around our house. It was a bizarre dream. It would be recurring. And so, of course, when I shared this with my father-in-law, he said, well, of course we need to have a Shiva Puja. You're having these bad dreams of black snakes crawling around. And I'm thinking, okay, all right. Okay, we're going to go to India. I'm going to sit down on the wet floor in a temple and pray over the snake god to take all this away. You know, kind of internally laughing about this.
You don't think this is going to be...
Oh, come on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you're going to go along with it.
Because he's my father-in-law, and I respect that.
Right.
You know? We're in Bhubaneswar in India, and it's known for its temples. In this puja, typically they're saying mantras, they're burning fire and incense and making sacrificial offerings of coconut and bananas and things that are symbolic in the Hindu religion to cast out, ward off evil spirits. And then part of it moves indoors inside the temple. And it moved indoor because we started having a major shower. We go indoors, and there's a stone statue coming out of the ground. Kind of the head, imagine the head of a cobra. You know, like a cobra ready to attack. You know, they've got flowers and garlands and the usual, and incense burning. The priest starts asking me to do certain things. Tell me about our business, what we do, problems we've had. We'd had a couple of car accidents, health issues. I was feeling old and lethargic. I'm only in my late 20s. You know, I had bags on my eyes. And he noticed immediately. He said, something's wrong. Here we are. So he asked me to start repeating these mantras. And, you know, my tongue at the time was thick. And I used to speak slowly. So he would start saying these things. And I'd have to repeat. And it was a struggle for me to repeat this stuff. Then he starts giving me these 3 or 4 leaf clovers, and he says, with your left hand, while you're saying the mantras, with one hand, start ripping them into pieces. So I'm saying the mantras and ripping these leaves. Then he goes, with your other hand, take some milk, and you're going to offer this. Yeah, thunder and lightning outside in the middle of a monsoon, pouring milk with my right hand over this stone statue coming out of the ground, repeating these mantras, like trying to do three things. And it's starting to be like a mental and physical strain on me. So he gives me this, looks like a quart of milk in a brass copper container. I'm pouring this milk, and I'm pouring, and it's going on for 5, 10 minutes, and the milk in the container won't finish.
What?
I kid you not. So
you're pouring the milk, and the milk's coming out.
There's goosebumps on my hand right now.
You're pouring the milk out.
I'm pouring milk out here, and it won't finish. And it takes so long that my right arm starts shaking. And so the priest turns to Anisha and says, "Your husband's having some trouble. You need to help him." And so he goes, "So take your hands, and when his arms are weak, you need to support him." So she reaches out, and she's not holding my arm. We're both getting tired. And in the meantime, I've still got the mantras going on. I've got the clover leaves, and this milk is not finished. There's a gust of wind, and the candles and the incense blow out. And they relight the candles and the incense, and the milk is finished. The priest stops and says to me, "I feel good about this." He goes, "Go back." He goes, "Your business is going to be fine. Your health is going to be fine. You just have to remember to do certain things and think about Lord Shiva." So I said, "Okay." You know, you're inside this 1,000-year-old temple, and you're pouring milk that won't finish, and there's incense and candles and the chanting and mantras and stuff, and you're like, and then all of a sudden, everything blows out. It's dark, and there's a gust of wind out of nowhere indoors. I finish up the puja, and we head back. And this is the part that gets strange. Came back, all of a sudden, just within a couple of months, business started just booming. I was working one day, and a gentleman just calls me out of the blue. And he says, "I've got to meet you. I've got a major tax issue, estate planning issue." So I go up. I said, "Well, gee, I feel bad. You know, this guy really wants to meet me." So I meet him halfway, and this guy drives probably more than halfway. We're supposed to meet at a hotel. I walk into the lobby. There's a gentleman sitting there that I pass by. He looks up, looks at me, and he stops. He goes, "Are you Lalat?" I said, "Yes." He goes, "Hi, I'm Dr. So-and-so. How old are you?" And I told him, very young. For the business that I'm in, I'm fairly young. He said, "There's something wrong with your eyes." He goes, "Are you cold? Are you cold all the time? Have you gained a lot of weight?" He started to ask me these questions. Then he shakes my hand. He goes, "I need you to do a blood test right away." I'm sitting there thinking, this guy's a loony. I've just dismissed this guy already. I'm driving back. What he's done is he's called my office and spoke to my father and left a message saying, "You guys need to make sure Lalat has a blood test."
He's all up in your business.
I was like, who is this guy? I come back down and my dad is freaked out. And my dad kind of twists my arm to do it. I get a call the next morning, first thing in the morning. "Lalat, we met yesterday. I got your blood results back. I need you to see me today, and I can't have you drive yourself up. You could fall asleep and go into a coma while you're driving.
Whoa.
I need someone else to drive." So get up there, and he said, "You know, in all my years, I've not seen anyone with their thyroxin or whatever it is called level at this level. You should technically not be having a conversation with me. You should already be in a mix, what he called a myxedemic coma." And he's
your checking. Levels of thyroxin
right.
are really, really low, so low that you should be in a coma.
Right, right. He checks it out and he says, "Here's the scale, normal range. Yours is like 100th of the low point of that range."
Wow.
"You're running on empty. Your car's got one drop of gasoline left. You should already be stalled." And he prescribes something to me. And I am going out of my mind, full of energy. I should have been in a myxedemic coma. Full of energy. Met this guy out of the blue. And within a couple of months, I started losing the weight, the excess water, speech started.
You, all of a sudden, that sluggishness of your speech went away entirely.
Entirely. I said, "Wow."
And when you first, I guess, saw him after that period, what did you think?
Well, maybe they went a little too overboard on the meds because he was moving at such a fast speed that no one really could keep up with what he was trying to communicate and say and what he was thinking.
Yeah, it was like complete transformation. And to this person who's now like, talk super fast, have the size of what he was, and now wearing color.
You married somebody else.
Yes.
What did you think about this new person? You're lying in bed next to some new guy.
Some new guy.
Let me ask you, could tell me, mind my own business.
Okay.
But I imagine that someone who is beaten down, lethargic, and slow,
yeah,
might not be as active intimately as they were after this thing happened. How did you respond to this whole new guy?
You know, we sometimes he would tell me, oh, he has to increase his doses. And I'm like, oh, please don't do that. I'm like, no, you do not need to increase your doses. You're good.
Clients would call up and say, we need to speak with Alot. And I'd say, Alot's speaking. I said, no, I think we got the wrong person. Clients, until they met me, couldn't believe, because, you know, I'm dealing with a lot of confidential issues. I had to go back and re-meet a lot of our clients. People started asking me, hey, what happened? And it's easy to say, well, I had this problem, it's medicine and this, and I really had to think about what happened. I'd say, hey, you know, I had this pucha and I don't know what happened, but a series of events that happened after that, I was diagnosed with this and I'm cured.
What if someone just said, look, this is coincidence. Coincidences happen. And this is a Western country. You should be diagnosed for an obvious condition.
If that's what someone wants to believe, that occasionally good coincidences and miracles happen, great. But to me, if it was one odd event, I think it would have said a coincidence. When there's a series of odd events, and there's someone at the other end said, told me that, hey, these series of odd events is likely to happen and change your life. Because someone at the other end wouldn't start it out. It was someone that I didn't believe.
Are you more devout?
Oh, no question. There are things that we don't understand, that I don't understand, but I know that they've impacted my life. And that, so I am much more conscientious and open to the idea that, hey, there was a transformative event. It's not explained by medicine. That was just the end result.
Big thanks to the Patnaik family for sharing that personal story. We here at Snap Judgment advise that you see a physician before you slip into any comas. Next up, a brown man joins the Ku Klux Klan, baby. The KKK. Stay tuned. We said it right here on Snap Judgment.
You are listening to the Snap Judgment podcast from NPR. If you've enjoyed what you heard so far, then please contact your local public radio station and let them know what other radio stations already know, that you want to hear Snap Judgment on the local airwaves. And if you, the listener, have a Snap Judgment story of your very own to share, we would love to hear it. You can send it to us by visiting our website at snapjudgment.org. You can also leave it on our story line by calling 888-304-SNAP. That's 888-304-7627. You are listening to Snap Judgment from NPR.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the show that borrowed some money from out of your purse and forgot to tell you about it. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we explore what happens when something's a little bit off. And let me tell you something. I know us. I know public radio listeners. And we can, this time, for once, let our nerd flag fly. Today's story, what happens when nerdism goes horribly wrong? Chandra Shivakumar gives us a tale of nerdism gone wild. Chandra, it's safe to say that you are a brown man.
Yes.
You have brown skin.
Yes, black hair, brown eyes.
And have you ever, because of your ethnicity, come across any racial prejudice?
Yes.
Could you describe an incident briefly for us where they just made it plain that, welcome to America, this is how things work here?
Yes. Well, my nickname in middle school was Gandhi. think that's just when the Attenborough movie had come out. So they called me Gandhi for years. And they would call my mother Mrs. Gandhi when the bus dropped me off. And then we used to spend the summers in South Carolina, and every once in a while guys would yell things out like, "Go back home, Brownie." I've had guns pointed at me.
Someone just pulled a gun on you and said...
No, these folks would drive by in their pickup trucks with their shotguns and guns, and once they aimed it at me. But I used to hear the N-word, you know, walking down the streets. And
they call you an N-word.
Yeah, these poor hillbillies got their...
Kind of confused.
Confused the brown men. So they'd be like...
We're all N-words here. That's...
So they'd throw the N-word out at me, and I'd just stand there a little dazed and confused.
Well, which brings home, I think, the story that we're about to hear from you. Could you set the scene for us?
Sophomore year, sometime in the fall, it was rush night. So that's the night that all these kids, all these little college kids at Bowdoin, 50% were in fraternities. That was the night they all join the frats, they get accepted, they got all drunk, they hook up. So my friends and I, we all lived together.
So you weren't rushing a frat?
No.
You and your nerdy friends then are hanging out by yourselves?
Yes, we decided we would hang out in our own frat.
Your own frat, a frat of no frat, so you guys are together, what are you doing?
So we sat there and we said, you know, all those idiots are out there drinking and joining their little frat friends.
Jerks.
Yeah. Jocks. So we said, hey, let's do something fun. We'll protest. We'll have our own little rush night.
Dungeons and Dragons rides again.
Something like that. So yeah, we like Dungeons and Dragons. That's true. A lot of Tetris as well. But yeah, we basically said, hey, let's do something fun and zany and goofy on our own. We don't need them stinking frats to have fun.
Right. So what do you do?
So we said, let's do something crazy. So we looked around the kitchen. We looked up on top of the fridge. There was this big box called Tastios. It was the poor student's version of Cheerios. We said, let us worship the god of Tastios tonight.
We're going to worship the god of Tastios.
Yep.
What exactly does that mean?
So we decided we would go and try and convert people to become devotees and acolytes of Tastios.
You too can worship at the god of Tastios.
Grabbed a big, huge bowl, filled it up with Tastios. We decided we needed to get into costume, the appropriate Tastios costume. So we just used whatever was available, like our bed sheets. Wrapped ourselves up in togas, grabbed the pillowcases, wrapped our heads up in turbans, got sunglasses on. Our friends, my friends involved here, Norman, little Chinese boy, Chandler and Putnam, old school white boys from the Mayflower. We all decided we would...
And the brown man.
And myself, the Sri Lankan from New York.
Here on Gilligan's Isle, we all go out and we are encouraging people to join us.
Yeah, we're going to proselytize for Tastios.
And what happened?
So Chandler had a guitar, Putnam had a mandolin, I had a harmonica.
Let me stop you though. You're dressed... You're wearing a
togas. Mine had blue sheep on it.
And you have sunglasses on your face.
Sunglasses, yeah. Yep, nothing covering your face.
And you have something wrapped around your head.
It's a turban, yeah. Just had a turban of our little bed sheet cover we wrapped around our head.
And you've got some candles.
We had one candle about 2 feet high.
And a bowl of Tastios.
Yeah.
And off you go.
Off we went, marching down the street. It took about half a mile to campus. By the time we got to campus, we had a few people, other students following us, laughing, joking. And every student we saw, we sprinkled a few Tastios on them.
Here you are. Go forth in peace.
Yeah, I think we had a whole song. Tastios, Tastios, join the god of Tastios.
Tastios, Tastios, join the god of Tastios.
Putnam and Chandler are professional musicians, and they were back then, too. They had their own band. So, you know, they were well-known. We were all members of the Asian American Students Union. I think I was the secretary. Putnam was vice president. Chandler was president. Norman was...
Let me get this straight. The white guys are members of the Asian Students Union. Why?
Well, they were more Asian than us. They'd spent time in Asia, in China, I think, in Japan. You know, they spoke Chinese or Mandarin, I think. So, they were really interested in... You know, Chandler was studying Chinese. Putnam had spent a year in China.
These are not posers.
No posers. Real deal.
So you guys are happy, throng, going down the street, encouraging everyone to join your band of Tastio's lovers. Everything's cool.
Yeah, basically a nice, peaceful, fun protest against the fraternities. Look here, folks, you can have a nice time without drinking and hooking up. That was our goal.
How dare you? This is subversive.
Yep. And yeah, we're radical for our time.
So what happened to you nerds later on? What went on with you?
So the nerds circled campus for a while, then we posted the big candle in the front, in the middle of the quad, and we basically danced and played music and jeered and danced around this candle. That's it. We danced around the candle for about 15 minutes, and people just watched and videotaped us.
So you go back home.
So we walked home. Nice, innocent, fun night. No Sounds harm, great. No foul.
Sounds good. You guys roll any 16-cube-headed dice later on the night?
That's right. I was trying to get up to 16 dexterity for my elven thief, but yeah, it didn't work out quite well.
Well, so good. Great. So we had a good night. You go to bed.
Had a good night. We were like, okay, good night, guys. That was really fun. See ya. Bam. 7 a.m. Phone rings. Putnam got it. Came around, knocked on all our doors, and said the dean. Dean Llewellyn, his name was. Dean Llewellyn wants to see us right away. And we said, what the hell is this about? I mean, we thought, all right, maybe it had something to do with last night, but gosh, we didn't do anything bad. So let's go. Hopped on all our bikes, and we went right to the campus.
You guys get on your little bikes and you pedal to see the dean.
Pedal away, yeah, in our pajamas, basically. We, you know, just rolled out
it's
of bed.
It's 7 in the morning on a Saturday morning.
So we walk in. He said, get in my office right away. He seemed a little peeved. So we walk in. He said, now tell me the truth. Were you guys walking around dressed up like the KKK last night?
Were you dressed up like the KKK? And were you, Chandra?
I was not. No, sir. And that's exactly
you
what we told Dean Llewellyn.
You were dressed up in togas.
Toga. Blue sheet.
And you had a sheet on your head. And
oh, no sheet on our head. We had a turban.
And you were yelling the N-word at every single person that came around. Is that true?
We yelled, Tastios, Tastios, come and get your Tastios.
N-word, N-word. N-word, go home.
I don't think the N-word had ever crossed our lips up to that point.
The Asian Student Association was at war with the Black Student Association. Is that not true?
False, sir. False, Your Honor. We were just having a fun, innocent night.
So
we had lots of black friends on campus there. We were
That's
friends
what they
with
all
everybody.
Say, Chandra. That's what they all say. We've got lots of black
our
friends.
Our best friends there were African-American. my favorite movie was Do the Right Thing.
It was. But Dean Llewellyn, he didn't see it that way.
So, yeah, he accused us. Like, is it true? Tell me the truth. You guys were walking around dressed up like the KKK last night. And for a split second, we said, what? You're crazy. That's hilarious. Ha, ha, ha. That's nuts. No way. You're crazy, Dean Llewellyn. We started laughing. He stopped our laughs with one cold, dead look. I mean, we were scared.
So the dean was letting you have it.
He laid into us, but he basically said, look, the phone has been ringing off the hook. I've not had a moment's sleep. The president of the college has been up all night receiving calls. We've been receiving calls from parents who are on the phone with travel agents getting tickets for the children to fly home.
They're pulling their kids out of school.
There were a few kids who were ready to leave camp. They were packed up, ready to go.
Oh, my God.
Yep. The African-American Students Union is calling for you to be expelled. The Jewish Students Union has been calling for you guys to be expelled.
There have been other things going on in the area.
Yeah, you know, little to our knowledge, there was heightened tensions in the community. So, for instance, the African-American students were already very upset because 20 miles away south in Portland, the KKK actually had been marching down the streets of Portland and pamphleting and leafleting. And then, of course, it turned out it was Rosh Hashanah.
This was Rosh Hashanah, the night of Rosh Hashanah. You were marching and being misconstrued
as a
KKK.
We're doing a silly little thing, yeah. And so the Jewish students immediately assumed that this was against them.
So what did he
do? So we were scared. And he said, look, we're going to keep discussing this. You need to go get character witnesses and really prove to me that you are not racist members of the KKK. And so we got out of there shaking. I mean, we were scared. So he said you should talk to your parents right now. There's a chance you are all going to be expelled. So we were very worried.
What'd you do?
We all went home. We started shaking and talking and saying, look, start mobilizing ourselves. You know, we went and obviously got every friend of color we had and had to tell them the story.
Did you know any black people?
Yes, we were friends with a few African-American students.
Was that helpful for you?
They saved us within 24 hours. They marched over there and said, Dean Llewellyn, these are good friends of ours. They in no way, shape, or form are associated or sympathize with the Klan. The dean then asked us, had we spray-painted swastikas on the side of the church, and had we burned a cross, because that's what the reports had come through.
You should not have done that.
No, we had nothing to do with swastikas, nothing to do with burning crosses. But again, this was the height of hysteria. That
had someone actually done that?
No. They saw our candle from the fourth floor window, and they thought we were the Klan. They assumed the candle was a cross, and they just saw exactly what they wanted to see, what they needed to see.
What they feared they saw.
Yeah, yeah. Fear is an amazing emotion.
When you realized how scared people were to have seen such a thing, how did you feel?
Yeah, no, we felt lousy. We felt very, very bad. I mean, we did not come back onto campus for a day or two, that's for sure.
And when you did, what was your reception?
Well, people had no idea it was us. So what happened was, basically, Dean Llewellyn said, look, you know what, you're not going to be expelled, but this is what's going to happen. You have to go personally apologize to the African-American Students Union, the Jewish Students Union, Hillel, the Latino Students Union, and the housing directors for the whole campus. Then you will then go and spend four sessions with Mrs. TK, who was the multicultural counselor for the campus. You will also arrange a symposium for the whole student body to attend, and you will publicly apologize in a written letter disclosing your full names.
How did this affect your relationships with friends and such on campus?
Well, here's the deal. I was Mr. Brown Man. So after we sent the letter out, we sent a letter that week saying, hey, this is us. We really apologize. We're just having fun. And we signed our names to it, Chandler Putt, Norman Chandra. So the two white boys were at home. They were very, very upset. I mean, a white guy labeled as racist is a racist white boy. For the next 3 weeks, students were interviewed by the school newspaper, and every week people were still saying, like, those kids should be expelled. I know they were racist, I'm sure they were racist, and they should be expelled. We went and spoke to the different unions, we apologized, people cried, they screamed, yelled at us. One African-American student actually had a cross burned on her lawn in Louisiana 4 days prior to this event. So she was very upset.
But you learned, too, that people, whatever their perception, however incorrect it was, were truly hurt by this incident.
Yeah, I mean, I was taking an African-American history class at the time, and the same thing came up. Like, 15 African-American students there, the incident was brought up. They started crying. You know, these three girls started crying. They said, I don't know why people have to be so mean. Why do people have to target us? And I was shaking. It was 80 people in the class. I was shaking in my chair. I couldn't even defend myself. So my friend Dan, this white boy, got up in front and said, look, one of those guys was a good friend of mine. It had nothing to do with the KKK. Please believe that. I mean, he had to get up and apologize on my behalf. I was very nervous.
Wait, how did that feel? You're sitting in the classroom. Three girls are crying about the perceived racist incident that happened on campus. You don't even feel comfortable in getting up and defending yourself. But a white fellow student, a friend of yours.
Friend of mine, yeah.
Who knows you're in the class.
Oh, I was sitting right behind him, yeah.
He gets up.
Well, he kept nudging me with his elbow to say something, and I simply could not. I was too scared. I was shaking, I mean, literally.
But
I was ashamed.
He doesn't identify you.
No, he did not. I stayed in my seat till everybody left. I slunk off.
How'd you feel?
Oh, I felt awful that I'd caused that kind of harm and dismay. And I was lucky, though. You know, I met with this woman, Mrs. TK, and she was the multicultural counselor. She was basically the advisor for all the African-American and Latino students on campus. Because obviously there weren't that many, and they're in Maine. So we were forced to see her, and that first time I saw her, I said, this is BS, I'm not apologizing to anyone, I hate this, blah, blah, blah. And I went off on her, and she, you know, she took it well. You know, later on, she said, hey, you know, I appreciated your anger, but I was not going to let you off the hook. We became eventually good friends. I helped her start ADAPT. It was a group that went around campus teaching other students about diversity. And I also dropped my environmental philosophy major and decided, you know what? I want to figure out why the students of color were so horrified and scared and felt so unsupported. So I started Mrs. TK became my advisor. I started the first ethnic studies major at Bowdoin College.
You yourself designed the first ethnic studies major at Bowdoin. This changed you, Chandra.
So yeah, this event changed my life. It really did.
That inadvertent snap judgment to go out with a bowl of Cheerios was a turning point.
Yeah.
Now, if you've got a story like Chandra's, actually, nobody has a story like Chandra's. If you have a story for Snap Judgment, let us know at snapjudgment.org. And you can even hit us old school, 888-304-SNAP. Now, coming up next, you know that guy with the beautiful woman in the beautiful car riding down the road, and you look at this smug and you think, how in the world? Well, coming up, Jack Boulware lets us in on their little secret. Stay tuned.
SnapJudgment.org is powered by Media Cannon. And Snap Judgment, the radio show, is inspired by Oakland Youth Speaks. Because tomorrow's youth can speak for themselves.
You're listening to Snap Judgment. My name is Glenn Washington, and we love being in the Bay. It's a home to all manner of storytellers, and one of the kings of the castle is this guy, Jack Boulware. He founded a group known as Litquake, one of the artistic treasures of the San Francisco Bay, and I got to sit down with him. You best believe I asked him to tell us a story. Jack Boulware, welcome to Snap Judgment. You've got a story for us. Is that right?
I do.
Tell me a little something. Tell me a story.
Well, this happened some years ago. I was a journalist. This major New York magazine asked me to write this short story, this piece about Ferdinand Porsche, the father of the sports car as we know it. So as I was writing this story, I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could really test drive a Porsche? So I called up the company and they said, sure, would 3 days be enough? And in the meantime, I researched the story and just turned it in. So this is what happened next. Around mid-morning, a man rings the doorbell of my apartment building. He's from a Porsche dealership in the East Bay. He smells of strong cologne. In front of my house is parked a brand new maroon Porsche 911 Turbo. It's worth $70,000.
And he just hands you the keys.
We talk for a little bit, and then he hands me the keys, yeah.
And does he speak to you in German?
No. He's an American guy. So I realize I'm barefoot, standing here, unshaven, in a T-shirt and shorts. I mean, I could be anybody. So I've got to be really professional here. And I ask him, where's the best place to really get it up to speed, see what she does? Without missing a beat, Mr. Cologne says, Highway 580, out towards Stockton. So I sign this piece of paper, he hands me the keys and walks off. He has no idea the article is already done. None of this is necessary. I immediately blow off the rest of the week. Day one. The first thing you notice when you have a Porsche is that the cockpit is designed to be as effortless as possible. I plop into the seat and everything is ergonomically perfect. My right hand is already resting on the gear shift, inches away from the parking brake. My left hand is already on the wheel. It's almost creepy how convenient everything is. I'm infant man, floating in the womb of this very organized German mother.
That's that German design, Jack.
They conquered a lot of Europe with that precision. So I pick up my buddy Tom, and we shoot across the Golden Gate Bridge like a couple of bastards from Hollywood, scouting locations and looking for chicks. We find a road that winds up Mount Tamalpais. Now, in a Porsche, a good general rule of thumb is if there's any speed limit posted, double it. The hairpin curves are suggested at 15 miles an hour. We take them at 30. If a freeway ramp is posted 30, 60's fine. We stop at the top of the mountain and take photos of ourselves, leaning smugly against the fender. At the end of the night, I park the Porsche and look out the window at its gleaming shape. I haven't owned a car in 10 years. And now this. Since my parking space is always empty, the hookers in the Western Edition often use it to turn tricks. Tonight, because the Porsche is in my spot, a prostitute and her customer will be forced to move operations down the block and struggle in the driveway of Ida B. Wells High School. And that makes me sad. But not that sad. I have a Porsche. Day 2. As I tool around the city, the car and I start to become one. I learn how to accelerate through a turn. Simply curl the toes of my right foot, and the turbo scoots through the curb like a toy slot car.
This is my car.
That's right. This is my car. Out of the way.
I'm driving places.
I got stuff to do.
I gotta go
in my car.
Right.
In my nice car that's nicer than yours. It's a status thing. Suddenly, you know, you realize that you're better than other people. People who never gave me the time of day are suddenly very interested. Guys in other sports cars admire my vehicle. If another Porsche driver catches my eye, he nods. I nod back. We are simpatico, members of the club. I can feel a slow and certain emergence of my inner ass. I now deliberately cut off people and accelerate in front of them. I roar off from every stoplight like it's a drag race. Sunglasses, even if they're cheap, suddenly take on deeper meaning. I'm regressing into an advanced state of frat boy douchebaggery, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. About 2 a.m., I head out towards Stockton. Highway 580 stretches for miles and miles, separated by this concrete divider. The car cuts through the blackness. It isn't even really designed to get humming until you're doing over 100. So, of course, you want to oblige its needs. I punch the pedal. The Porsche drills me into the seat. I can hit about 125, and I start talking to myself in a bad German accent. You people bore me. I have toyed with you, and I'm tired of your ineffectual cars and the puny performance. I leave you now. Day 3. The Porsche has now completely taken over my life. I blab about it to anyone who will listen. I invent meaningless errands just so I can drive it around in public. And today, I'm going to completely succumb to its power. I call up a girl I barely know, a former model who now sports a fashionable combination of tattoos and rehab. As I soon discover, pretty light on the rehab part of the equation. It's a last night with the Porsche, so I suggest we go for a drive down the coast to Half Moon Bay. She wants to stop in the Mission District along the way. So we pull up in front of this sleazy bar, and she runs inside and comes out with this envelope of sickly yellow-colored powder. Here we go. A voice inside my head is yelling, "My God, what are you doing?" But when fate dangles that Hunter Thompson fantasy in front of you, the regret outweighs the shame.
Tell me this, though. Would you ever have done it without the car?
No. Now, the previous night, the Porsche and my brain were functioning together in this fluid harmony. Now, the car has the upper hand. My brain can't possibly synchronize with a quick steering and acceleration. We creep through these hairpin turns. The fog surrounds us, bathing us in its death mist. I'm coked up and drunk, listening to a chatty girl I don't even know in a $70,000 car for a story that's already turned in. I flash on James Dean. He was driving a Porsche when he died. How fast was he going? How fast am I going? Was he having fun when he crashed? Will there be anything left of us? I just filled up the tank. Does that mean when I roll it, the car will explode in a fireball like the movies? Miraculously, we don't die. The next morning, Mr. Cologne drops by to pick up the car. I put on sunglasses and I go to the door because I just look horrible. I look like the last person he would trust with a car, you know. And I've got shorts on, a t-shirt. I mean, I'm not in very good shape. He asked me how it was. You know, I want to tell him, just take this thing away from me. I can't handle the commitment, the lifestyle, the responsibility.
You have failed the car.
I can't do it. I can't do it. The car is for somebody other than me.
Right.
Because it's worn me out. It's turned me inside out like a ringer. I don't even want to think about it anymore. I give him the keys back, and he asks me, you know, how was it? How was it? And I want to say all this, but instead I just say, it was okay. I stumble back upstairs, exhausted, full of toxins, and I don't get out of bed until it's dark. I get an email from this magazine that assigned me this story. The reason I did this whole thing in the first place, and they said they decided not to run it after all.
Jack Boulware, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you get a bus pass from now on.
Now here's the rule, and it's not even really that hard. When you're in a Muslim country, never, ever, never, 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 ever, never, ever disrespect the Prophet. You just don't do it. And you got some friends, they want to go out and clown, say, hey, let's go over here, do this and that. You say, no. And so I was enjoying myself working in Malaysia. It's a beautiful country, beautiful people. I was sad to have to leave. Everybody told me, everybody said, before you go home, you've got to go see the National Mosque. You've got to see the mosque. I took a bus. I got off. I bought a robe. And I walked up to the building. A guard checked me out, looked me up and down. Everything's cool. Then he bent down and said, no pictures. Before pointing me inside the mosque. And the thing was, everybody was right. The first step inside was heart-stopping. Islamic arches soared stories into the sky. Sunshine bounced off of blue-tiled frescoes. And the heart of the mosque, the center, reserved for the faithful at prayer, was bathed in reflected green sunlight. It felt holy, set apart. And everywhere there were signs saying no pictures to protect the prayerful. And I just felt lucky, just lucky to be there. The arches, the silence, the dance of green and blue, and it was just me by myself to enjoy it. Then the heavy steps, the smacking of lips, and oh, Casper, this is beautiful, beautiful. I'm in a mosque on the other side of the world, and still Team Midwest has tracked me down. Well, Nancy, I'm just going to get my camera and see if I can take just the one picture, just the one. Casper, you really should. Casper reaches inside his day bag, grabs his camera, brings it up to his eyes for the shot, and I tried. I did try, but before I could get the words out of my mouth, several turban giants appeared. They're running full stride, these serious uniform brothers. They wrap Casper and Nancy away like Tupperware, hands over hollering mouths, camera snatched off the ground, nobody around, done before it even got started. I'm wondering, did that even happen? Silence. Like before the invasion. Now, did I shed a tear for the unfortunate fate of my countrymen? I did not. I did not. Embarrassing me. Didn't they know the rule? And looking back, it might have been right there, in my contempt was born the seed of my own catastrophe. Just a few hours later, a couple of my boys were giving me the traditional expat send-off at the local watering hole. When we finally left the bar, the sun was back in the sky, and they insisted on taking me to the airport themselves. Cool. Along the way, we pulled over into a rest area. Now, in the developing world, you never know what a restroom is going to look like. It could be something out of the Four Seasons, or it could be a hole in a plank, you never know. We walked into the building, and immediately, we saw a door for men and a door for women. So far, so good. We opened the men's door, and there's a large trough of water. And really, this was better than we expected. I let the German and the Englishman fight each other for ground, and I waited my turn in the hall. And as I stood there, waiting, the caretaker of the building approached me. He smiled. I smiled back. Toilet? Yeah, toilet. The man pointed down the hall. He pointed way down the hall. And suddenly, I realized that I was going to perish in a dark prison. No one would ever see me again because I had gotten cocky. I had broken the one rule. You see, I wasn't waiting outside a toilet at all, no. The faithful in Islam on long journeys often stop along the road to clean themselves in water before kneeling in prayer to Allah. On water. The same water my friends were urinating in. Maybe I blinked, maybe my arm twitched, but the caretaker got suspicious and was sniffing, tore the door aside, and saw the full abomination with his own eyes. Run! No questions, no jokes, fools ran, pants flapping. The alarm was blaring, the caretaker was screaming. I knew we were going to die. I floored the car and hoped that everybody that needed to be was inside the ride because there was no going back. We could never go back there. It was later when I saw Nancy and Casper at the airport bar. They didn't recognize me, and I asked if I could buy them a drink. Sure, Nancy said, if I can buy you one. Gin and tonics all around. We talked about Ohio State versus Michigan football, and then the what brings you to Malaysia? Oh, said Nancy, we're going everywhere we can while Casper can still see it. Casper grew on it. Nothing too crazy, he said. My eyes just aren't what they used to be. I can't see distance very well anymore, so I take pictures. I print them out. I get to see my vacation for the first time sitting on my couch back home. Wow. Really? Yeah, in fact, let me get a picture of you right now. I leaned in next to Nancy. I looked directly at the camera. And I smiled just as broadly as I could. You've been listening to Snap Judgment. My name is Glenn Washington. Snap Judgment was produced by myself and executive producer Mark Ristich. The God of War and Radio, Roman Mars. Special thanks to Dungeons & Dragons for giving us that 16-level dexterity points, baby. DJ, a.k.a. on the ones and twos, come visit at snapjudgment.org. And special, tremendous thanks to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Don't forget PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. And even though this is not the news, it's so far from the news. In fact, you could put on one of those spy masks and go live in a yurt in Antarctica, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. This is NPR. The producer of this very podcast, listening, judging, and condemning all she hears out of my mouth right now, is Snap Judgment's own podcast producer, Rita Daniels.